Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast. And a warm welcome to Afternoons with Bill Arnold. That's me. I'm awfully glad you joined me today. We're going to have so much fun today. I can hardly wait. Hour two is going to be the return of Susie Larson. We're going to talk about her new book, which is called Fully Alive, Learning to Flourish Mind, Body, and Spirit. And I would love for you to send a little love note to Susie. You can text it. That way we can have some love mail just to get the hour started. That's from 4 to 5. But you can start sending text messages right now to her at 877-933-2484. 877-933-2484. And also in the first hour, we've got coming up my friend and colleague from prestigious West Des Moines, Patrick Albanese, will be with me. And then Cal Beisner will be with me as well in the second part of that first half hour. That's going to be the show. It's going to be a great one. So glad that you're with me today. I'll take a little break and bring Patrick on in just a minute.
Hi, I'm Dick Whitworth, General Manager of Faith Radio. Recently, Mary sent us a note and said this: I know that God loves us. I know that His mercies are new every morning. But I also know that He has called us to encourage one another, to help us get an understanding of love, forgiveness, grace, and the gift of eternal life. And Faith Radio helps me do just that. Thank you, Mary, and thank you, friends, for making stories like Mary's possible. Your ongoing monthly support of Faith Radio keeps us going and growing. Whether you listen over the air, online, or on demand, Faith Radio is delivering relevant Bible preaching and family-focused teaching thanks to you. If you're not already a member of the monthly support team, would you consider joining? You can give a gift today online at myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com. Thank you again for listening. Thank you for praying and supporting this ministry. God bless you.
What would you do with a brain if you had one?
Do? Why, if I had a brain,
I could while away the hours, conferring with the flowers, consulting with the rain. And my head, I'd be scratching while my thoughts were busy hatching if I only had a brain.
Happy Monday. I'm so glad you're with me today. As you know, my regular guest, Patrick Albanese, is not only a friend, but he is a colleague. And I use that term loosely because I'm not sure what it means. But he lives in West Des Moines, Iowa, and he is formerly from a member of Channel 8 News Team, WHO Radio, comedian and magician and great friend. Welcome to the show, Patrick.
Okay, and thank you. The definition of a colleague is somebody you feel comfortable borrowing money from and not returning.
That makes about sense. All right, yeah. Busy weekend, a lot of stuff happening. I didn't follow much because I needed to unplug, and for good reasons. There's lots of bad stuff going on, a lot of bad news, and the whole idea of this gigantic caravan coming in, attempting to come into the U.S., I think is a stunt. I'm not sure.
It sure does feel like a stunt. The fact that it keeps growing and then they stop for these photo opportunities, because I don't know about you, I'm a relatively brisk walker, but these people are covering 1,700 miles in like a day and a half on foot. I'm not buying it. So I get the feeling that somebody says, "Here, hop on the train. We'll go for a bit. Ooh, this, look at this backdrop. This makes for a good scene." But then, some video gets caught of people ripping down fences and tearing down walls and getting stuck on a bridge, and then they're waving Honduran flags. And I noticed that today, the pictures today, no flags. So somebody got a message out and said, "God, put away the flags. You're going to America. You're going to America."
Mm-hmm.
Optically, it's bad, and it makes me think that somebody thought it would help with an election coming up. I mean, you question the timing. You say, "God, did people that are maybe more for the open borders and they're trying to tug at some heartstrings with these stories of these people just seeking a better life, saying, look at them all." You're going, gosh, it's gotten to be a little bit too large of a group now, because if this were to happen, a couple of times a month with a group this large, we would all start to question, how are we going to take care of all these people? And when will our effective ability to take care of them well run out, and suddenly you'd say, gosh, we put too many people in the lifeboat, and it sunk.
Mm-hmm. And I look at the issues of homelessness and all of the problems that Seattle's having, for example. The business owners there are saying that the city's homeless are making them hard to even keep their businesses open because of the little tent cities that now exist in front of their businesses. And yeah. As a Christian, as believers, how do we come alongside these dear people created in the image of God, help them to get from a place of homelessness to a place where they can be back living in society, thriving, paying for their expenses, paying taxes, doing all of the above, being off drugs and alcohol if they're addicted?
Yeah, and that's going to be the really tough one. You know, one of the problems that goes with these tent cities is the needles that come with it.
Mm-hmm.
And coincidentally, I think Seattle even has one of those needle programs where they say, hey, we don't want you to risk getting a disease, so come get free needles. Well, people take advantage of that. And so now you have discarded needles everywhere. You know, we were in California recently, and on some of the beaches, people will say, you might want to keep the flip-flops on. You got to watch out for needles on the beach. It's like needles on the beach. And chances are whatever's left in that, you know, syringe or the needle is not something you want in your body.
Mm-hmm. But Patrick,
so how do you do it as a Christian?
I don't know. Yeah, we have
at risk, of course.
We have it in our hearts to care for people who are marginalized and on the fringe of society. But how do we help them and help them become what God has designed them to be, which is living in a state of flourishing? If they don't want it, then what do you do?
And how do you even trust? Excuse me a second. But, you know, would you open up your own home to some of these people you would see in a tent city? And I think the majority of people would say, well, I don't know if I would do that. You'd say, well, if your goal is to help them, why wouldn't you do that? And you would say, well, I have to draw a line where it could negatively impact my family. So, you know, where somebody might want to beat you over the head with, you know, why don't you care about these people and allow this tent city to spring up in your neighborhood? You'd say, because that negatively impacts my neighborhood and not just my real estate value, but my neighborhood. My kids can't walk to the park anymore safely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we deal with where I live. There are a lot of apartment complexes in the neighborhood that have sprung up to take care of. We have a lot of people that come in and work on HB1 visas for the tech companies here. And they tend to be transient because they're on a 1 or a 2 year contract. So they're only going to stay for a short period of time. And the sad thing is my daughter and son make friends with some of the kids that then, you know, they're whisked off to North Carolina for the next contract. And, you know, there isn't that stability that you say, I still have friends that I talked to from when I was 3. I'm sure you do too.
I do too. Yeah.
Aren't just siblings, you know?
Right.
Well, like I said, we talk to them. I would want more of that for my kids. But, do you want a tent city next to where you live a couple of blocks down where you'd say, I don't want my kids going out at night? And does that make you a bad person because you're saying, I'm just concerned. I'm not saying these people are going to attack them. But, gosh, what if my kid does step on a needle? Or what if somebody offers them drugs?
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to keep my child from that life.
Well, what about zoning laws in cities where zoning laws are there for a reason? So an adult bookstore can't go up next door to a church.
Or vice versa. I think
that's
vice versa,
yeah.
Right. I don't know because I've seen in too many cities. I was telling you earlier, I was working in Denver, Colorado, and they have this 16th Street Mall, kind of a pedestrian paradise where they say, we no longer allow vehicles on this road, and you walk it and it's all set up for storefronts and it's supposed to be this fantastic area to shop. But they also allowed the homeless population to come in, and these people would park in front of storefronts. And so now you have this problem where people want to go there because you park once and you can shop walking up and down the street. But at every storefront, there'd be a group of 10 to 12 teenagers with their own little boom box playing some music and all asking you for a little bit of cash on the way in. And, you know, your heart in one hand goes out for people that you say, I don't know if you're really down on your luck. I don't know if you're just an opportunistic kid saying, you know, everybody's so generous here. I don't know the story, But I do know that I get to the point personally where I go, I don't want to go shopping there anymore because I just kind of want to go into Walgreens and get some Band-Aids. You know, that's it.
Yeah.
So do you feel like a less of a person, like you're not a very good Christian if you won't go there and say, here's a couple of bucks for your trouble?
Yeah, it's a good question.
I find my church, and this is an answer. This is an answer, which is very rare for me, as you know. But my church does a tremendous amount of outreach, and they have food available. And when they do a food drive during the Super Bowl, for instance, it's unbelievable. They can fill every pantry in Des Moines. They do such a successful job of raising mountains of food. And these are places where people can go and get a meal. And there are places that my church supports where you can go lay your head down in a shelter and have and get yourself off the street. And, of course, some of the restrictions are you can't bring alcohol or drugs in here. But there are tremendous places where you can put your effort. Meals from the Heartland, I've gone and packaged meals there. And it's a tremendous feeling. We're saying, look, these are actual meals that are going to go to people. And you're going, if you're actually hungry, here's food.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a great way to help. And you know that it's going to the right place. That it, you know, you sometimes wonder if you hand somebody cash, what happens with it. But when you go and you donate food, you know exactly where that goes,
mm-hmm.
right into somebody's belly.
Yeah, it is a complicated issue, and I don't often know why I bring it up because I don't have answers. I do know that people created in the image of God are all around us that are in dire situations, and I keep praying when I see them that God would help them, and I try to do my best, but there.
Remember that year when you said, you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to, anybody who asks, I'm going to make them a pumpkin loaf. And that lasted about 20 minutes, didn't it? You made one pumpkin loaf and you said, this is a lot of work.
Yeah, it was way too much work. So the pumpkin loaf theory didn't last more than a day. But I appreciate you bringing that up.
Yeah, sore spot, I'm sure.
All right. My regular guest is Patrick Albanese. We will take a very short break and be back with more in just a minute. My colleague, my friend in prestigious West Des Moines. And Patrick, for many of you who may not know, is not only a magician and comedian, but he is, at one point, was the manager of the largest privately held club in the world. And I was thinking often about the way in which you would have to deal with employees and offer leadership. And I was curious, you were the master at offering constructive feedback to employees and getting the best out of them. And I think it was because you were always lighthearted with them, generous with praise, and you simply were willing to do whatever you were asking them to do and model it for them. And I always kind of look back with great admiration for how you conducted yourself in that role.
I always found that an opening statement with somebody that was problematic would be, look, everybody wants to fire you but me. No, it's in fact, I was back at this club a couple of months ago. We were on vacation, and it's been there over 50 years, and it's still wonderful. And there was a guy working there whose job I saved once. The board of directors, there were people that said they didn't like his attitude. And I said, you don't understand how hard this guy works. And I don't know if it was ever anything I ever said to him. And I stopped working there almost 20 years ago. So we're going back in time. And he's still there. And I don't know what people remember. But both he and his wife were working there. And I show up with my family. They don't know we're coming. And they roll out the red carpet. And he was introducing one of the shows. And he says, in fact, this guy here, this used to be my boss. And he's why I'm here today. And I got to tell you how good that felt.
Oh, I bet.
Not because I saved anybody's job, but because I knew how good he was. I knew how good he was. And sometimes, you know, I find, because I would struggle my own days going into work, and you're going, gosh, I really have not such a great attitude today. And everybody's kind of clawing at me and everybody wants something. But I used to give myself my little pep talk on the way in that was, hey, you made a deal. with your employer that said that you would do these duties and you accepted all the terms of that agreement. So the minute you walk in the door, the minute you punch that clock, you are on those terms. You're not allowed to not obey those terms. You have agreed to them. You don't get to say, that's not what I'm paid for. You don't get to say, that's not my job. It's like, hey, it probably is your job. Chances are the reason why people are coming to you is it's your job. Mm-hmm. And that talk worked really well because, and in a way, I used to like to look at it and say, let's be grown up here. Let's not be a child that just wants to get out of something. I only had to fire two people in my time there. And it was one of the most unpleasant things ever that I've had to do. And I told myself, I don't think I ever want to be in a position of ownership, management, or anything ever again, because it's hard. Even if the person, you say, golly, I have 174 write-ups on you. That's this week. And we're running out of wiggle room, you know. Uh-huh. So I'm just going to have to give you this one little warning. It was hard, even if, you know, in a sense you're saying this person, it's not that they deserve it. It's like this needs to be done.
Yeah.
This person isn't.
They've earned it.
They're not an asset to the business at this point. They're a liability to the business. And if I don't clean up this mess, then somebody's going to come to me and say, you are no longer an asset to this business. You are a liability to this business.
Mm-hmm.
It was tough, but other people, you know, that might've had a chip on their shoulder with attitude. I sometimes found, you know, normally you want to avoid those people. Those are the people I made my friends. As weird as that may sound, I worked at a restaurant for a short period of time, was owned by some friends of mine. And one of the managers there detested me. She detested me, had nothing but negative to say to my face. I can only imagine what she would say behind my back. And I'd come home and I'd say to my wife, I'm going, this woman does not like me. I don't even know why. And my wife would say, well, maybe you should find out why she doesn't like you. And so I kind of asked.
How'd that go?
It went extremely well. It seems like you don't like me very much, and I don't really know why, but my best guess is that you might think that I'm here, that I'm after your job. I'm not. Not interested in your job whatsoever, because I've seen what it's done to you. No, I just, if that's what it is, mm-hmm. I'm actually here to work for you. You're my boss. You just tell me what you need me to do, and I'll do it. We became the best of pals, and I think that was her fear. She never really fessed up to anything, but I evidently had to put her at ease. It's like, are you thinking I was hired to, you know, replace you? Because I'm not. I'm not here for that. I'm going to become your boss.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. But it's, you know, sometimes you don't know why somebody might be going through a particularly rough time. You don't know their home personal situation. You know, with the guy at that club that I worked at, he and his wife had been trying to have a baby, and she was going through fertility treatments, and it was making life miserable for the two of them. And they've been trying for 3 years.
Mm.
And they're two very close friends now.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So somebody took some time and said, what's going on with you guys? Oh my gosh, I didn't know you were trying to do that. So, you know, maybe take a little extra effort. I'm not the advice giver here. All I know is, you know, I've been in situations and I thought maybe the best reaction for me is the opposite. Instead of fighting back, let me see what's going on here.
Mm-hmm. When you have to give someone feedback, can you tell the difference between feedback and criticism?
Yes, that took a while, you know, and actually a lot of that is thanks to you in an sort of an offhanded way. Mm. Working in a show and, you know, prior to working in Triple Espresso, a play that has a director, I was a guy that just did solo performing. And so you're kind of your own critic. You might have a couple of close friends that could say, hey, I think this would work better for you. And I was not entirely comfortable or used to having somebody give you a stack of notes about your performance. And you'd say, but pardon me, are you telling me I did things incorrectly. I beg to differ. I'm the professional here.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a little while for me to get comfortable with, he wants me to look good. He's not giving me notes to make me look bad. I think things look a certain way. He's objective. Maybe I should yield to the guy who has the objective eye here. You know, you trained me into the job and you'd give me a bunch of notes. You know, sometimes it'd be prefaced with, this is probably something you can't do, but I'm going to give you a note anyway.
Or you're going to probably hate hearing this, but here it is.
Well, and that was funny. My one of my very close friends, we had a small business building props together. And one of the things we used to do, and I did this with one of the other workers, performers in Triple Espresso. We'd say, maybe the best way to get the whole, criticism thing over with is if you wanted to give somebody a note or an idea, is we would walk up to each other and say, all right, just so you know, you're going to have some nasty things to say to me in a couple of seconds. So get them out of your system now, and then I'll tell you what I'm going to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
And it did an amazing job because it completely softened the, you know, we would be like, you're a jerk. What
yeah.
do you know?
Right, right. But it enables you to think without feeling defensive once you sort of get that out of your system.
Yeah, because when somebody says, hey, I got a note for you, the wall goes up.
Totally.
I got a critique or criticism. So it might be, hey, I tell you what, just get it out of your system now. So the first thing they do is they blow that steam off. And then you say, I think this might work better for you. And you'll find a really receptive guy. And I know that worked for me on the vice versa. If somebody came to me and said, hey, I got something for you. So, you know, go blow off some steam and then come back and get the good news.
Yeah. Patrick Albanese has been my guest. Thank you so much, as always, Patrick, for being such a great, fun guest on the show. We've got Cal Beisner coming up in just a few minutes, and then hour two is going to be Susie Larson. We've already heard from some listeners. If you want to send Susie a welcome note, we would love to hear about it. You can send that to 877-933-2484. That way we can have some love mail when she comes on the air. She's talking about her new book, Fully Alive, Learning to Flourish Mind, Body, and Spirit. We're going to have Susie Larson with us for the whole hour. But coming up in the next half hour, before Susie arrives at 4 o'clock, we're going to be talking to Cal Beisner. And Cal is going to talk about income redistribution and equalization from a biblical standpoint. Cal is from the Cornwall Alliance, one of the brightest guys I have on the show. So that is all up next. Again, if you want to send a love note to Susie, 877-933-2484. We've got a great show planned just for you. We'll be right back in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. It is 31 minutes after the hour. Bill Arnold here with you all afternoon. Looking forward to the rest of the show because I have Cal Beisner already on our studio line. And then in hour two, we'll have Susie Larson for the whole hour. So I'm looking forward to that. I was just looking at the headlines in the news, and it looks like this lawyer, Michael Avenatti, is now talking about, he's thinking about suing people. Does he have any idea what it costs to get a good lawyer? I don't think that's a good idea. Anyway, Cal Beisner is one of my favorite guests, and for good reasons. You'll find out in a minute. He is one of the great thinkers out there, and he is the founder of the Cornwall Alliance, and he's written a book called Social Justice Versus Biblical Justice, How Good Intentions Undermine Justice and Gospel, and we're here to talk about it with him this afternoon. Hello, Cal.
Howdy, how you doing?
I'm
great
good.
To be back on the show with you.
It's
appreciate
so nice.
You letting me in.
Oh yeah, you kidding? I'll have you on any time. You're so interesting and such a great guest. So thank you for coming on. Did you watch Mark Levin last night? I'm just curious.
Well, I did see the portion where he had Patrick Michaels on.
That's what I was talking
Patrick
about, yeah.
He was a friend of mine. Yeah, I guess.
I figured you guys hang out together.
That you had in mind.
Yeah, play racquetball on Wednesday. What else? What did you think of that interview?
Well, I thought it was excellent. Pat Michaels, as I said, is a good friend of mine, and he is an outstanding climate scientist, very veteran in the field. And he just pointed out some of the very basic problems with the whole United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the big fat report that it just released a couple of weeks ago that has dominated headlines about climate change ever since then.
Mm-hmm.
Pat pointed out that, frankly, the computer models on which the IPCC depends predict, as Pat put it, 7 times as much warming as actually observed. That's a bit of a bigger estimate than I've typically gone with, but whether 7 times or 3, the fact is they're wrong, and they're grossly wrong, and so they really can't justify any kind of predictions about mm-hmm. future temperature or any policies to deal with it.
Is there a more, well, I suppose there is, but this has got to be in the top 3 most volatile issues today, climate change.
Well, yeah, it certainly is, and it has been, for years. That is really among sort of the politically active. When you actually poll ordinary folks, mm-hmm. it turns out that climate change is near the bottom of all environmental issues in their minds, and environmental issues for Americans are near the bottom of all concerns. So climate change may entertain the glitterati and the politicos, but it really doesn't seem to interest ordinary Americans terribly much.
Yeah. I was interested in your friend. Is it Patrick Michaels?
Yes.
Yes. And I did a little quick Google search on him, and I saw someone who was in opposition to him, and they were giving him his profile on their website, and they conveniently omitted that he was a PhD. They never put the doctor in front of it. They completely left that out. They made it sound like he was just a guy that didn't know much.
Yeah, longtime professor of meteorology and atmospheric science at the University of Virginia, which is not exactly one of the most bogus institutions in the world.
Yeah.
It's a premier educational institution, and it's a whole program in environmental sciences among the tops in the world. He was there for many years before, about a decade and a half ago, he shifted over to the Cato Institute and heads up their climate science program.
Mm-hmm. All right, Cal, I've got a bunch of questions for you on wealth redistribution. Can you tell me what the Bible teaches so we can understand what the Bible teaches about wealth redistribution and equalization?
Okay. Well, what it tells us is that we should be very generous and loving and compassionate in our giving to those who are in need. That's the first thing that I can say about it. That's a common theme all through the Bible. You even find when Paul is reporting back to the apostles in Jerusalem, he tells us in Galatians 6:10, that the one thing that they asked him to remember was to take care of the poor. And he said, that's the very thing that I was intent on doing. Deuteronomy tells us over and over again that God's people are supposed to take care of the poor. But all of that is voluntary. That is, it's not something that God ordained the state to enforce. And what happens nowadays a great deal, and I argue this in my booklet, Social Justice versus Biblical Justice, what happens nowadays is that people confuse these instructions to private individuals and to churches with instructions to the state, to the government. And so then they think, the government should be redistributing wealth. It should be pursuing some sort of policy to minimize inequality among people. And that is not something that the Bible teaches. And in fact, I think it teaches quite the opposite. The government is supposed to enforce justice. And justice means rendering to everyone his due. That is what reflects his behavior, his activities. Well, since people don't do the same things, they are not due the same things. And so to you know, force the outcome that everybody gets the same thing or approximately the same thing is actually to do the opposite of justice. It's to do injustice.
So, Kel, I know there's a lot of progressive-type folk who would say that there is a biblical principle of justice that does, in fact, require redistribution. That's not true, though, huh?
Well, yeah, a few will try to make that case, and they typically appeal to one of four different themes or passages in the Bible. One is the sabbatical year law discussed in Deuteronomy 15, which says that every seventh year the Israelites were supposed to, the Hebrew word means suspend or let drop debts. Unfortunately, the NIV translation translates that as cancel, but the verb itself really can't take that sense, and where it's used elsewhere, it obviously doesn't have that sense. The idea there, though, really was you're not supposed to collect on debts during the sabbatical year because everybody was supposed to rest during the sabbatical year and not cultivate or harvest land, and so people wouldn't have something with which to pay. But after the sabbatical year was over, debt collection would resume. So that's the first one.
Okay, I have to stop you, Cal, because that's pivotal, because I would think that my recollection from what I've learned is just the opposite, that everyone got their debts canceled. So I'm learning a lot from you today, yeah. Like I always do.
Yeah,
just
well,
so you know.
If you look at the same verb that occurs in Deuteronomy 15:1 for cancel in the NIV, let drop in many other translations, if you look at that same verb in Exodus 23:11, we're told that the Israelites were supposed to let drop their land during the sabbatical year, and that they were to let drop their work on the Sabbath day. Well, does that mean that they would never go back to farming the same land again? They'd only farm it for 6 years,
no,
and then never again? Or they'd never go back to work after taking the Sabbath day off? No, of course not. It's a temporary suspension in order to ensure that all the Israelites could enjoy a sabbatical year.
All right, let's talk about justice, because maybe we should start by defining justice biblically.
Yeah. Yeah, I spent a great deal of time doing that back in the 1980s. I did deep research into all the uses of the terms in both Hebrew and Greek for justice and righteousness, which are basically synonyms. And I came to this conclusion that the biblical definition of justice is rendering impartially — there are no favorites here, right? — and proportionally, that is, the reward should fit the crime, right, to everyone, and that means we're speaking about individuals, not groups here, his due, that is, what he's earned, what he deserves, according to the righteous standard that is God's moral law. So we get these criteria: impartiality, proportionality, desert, just desert, and the definition of what is just and right is the moral law of God. This is a far cry from the Marxist notion of justice as from each according to his ability to each according to his need. That actually lifts that phrase out of Acts chapters 2 and 4, where the early church is said to have given from each according to his ability to each according to his need. But there, it's not a matter of justice. It's a matter of love. It's a matter of grace and charity.
Very well spoken. I thought that was – I'm going to have to go back and listen to this again and take some notes, because it was so well laid out. But I would like for you to talk a little bit about – justice and rights. How do we separate those two?
Yeah, there's an enormous amount of confusion about rights in America today. When our founding period, the founders of America typically thought of rights as rights against harm. That is, they had a view of what are called negative rights. So, for instance, my right to life is actually not so much a right to life as a right not to have somebody else take my life away unjustly, right? Or a right to food is actually not so much a right to food as a right for people not to take away my food unjustly. But unfortunately, and again, this draws back to the ideas of Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, Nowadays, a lot of people embrace what are called positive rights, rights to benefits. The problem with positive rights is that if you're going to have government supply, enforce the supply of a right to, say, a basic amount of food or a basic housing or basic education or basic health care, et cetera, government doesn't create things out of thin air. In order to give something to Joe, government must take from Mary. And what that means is that in order to supply Joe's so-called positive right, government has to violate Mary's negative right. Now, you see, you can enforce all negative rights without any contradiction. If all of us were committed to it, we could all keep ourselves from punching each other in the nose. And by doing
what
that...
What fun would that be?
Right. We wouldn't violate anybody's rights by that.
Mm-hmm.
But in order to ensure that everybody comes up with a certain amount of income or something like that, well, for those who don't produce that income, to make them come up with it, you have to take away from some who do.
Mm-hmm.
Positive rights are actually unbiblical. They are not rights at all. And I discuss that at some length in my booklet, Social Justice versus Biblical Justice, which, by the way, we're giving away from the Cornwall Alliance this month.
Now I know our listeners are going to want to get a hold of this, so let's just give them the specific web address to go to.
Yeah, that's cornwallalliance.org, cornwallalliance.org, and if they'll click on the donate button, and for whatever amount they want to give us, as
mm-hmm.
our way of saying thank you, we'll send a copy if they'll just ask for the Social Justice booklet.
Yeah, your resources are great, Cal, just so you know. I've regularly made contributions and have gotten some great stuff, so thank you for that. I want to ask you about, I see in the news there's a particular politician in his city who wants to just start giving people who are in need $500 a month. So is that a good idea?
No. First, because it's unjust. I mean, where is the government going to come up with that $500?
You're getting back to the Joe and Mary thing.
Yeah, right. We're getting back to the Joe and Mary.
Yeah, I feel sorry for Mary.
Yeah, right. You should.
Yeah.
But the second reason that it's not a good idea is quite simply that when you do that, you undermine the incentive for people to be productive for themselves. Basically, you know, Bill, when we do that to people, we're treating them like pets, not like human beings.
Mm-hmm.
God created us in his image to be creative and productive as he is. And when we guarantee that somebody gets all the meals that he needs without having to work for them, we're really treating him like Fido or, you know, like Inky or Black Cat, you know, something like that. We're not treating him like a human being. Human beings have dignity, and they express that dignity partly through work and production. Now, people who are literally unable because of a physical handicap or a mental handicap or both to work to produce for themselves, of course we should take care of those people. But I say we, I don't say the government, I say we in the churches should take care of such people. And by the way, the churches have plenty of resources to take care of those who are truly disabled in our society. In fact, if Christians would tithe, and I actually did the math on this a number of years ago, if Christians would actually tithe, giving a 10% of our income to our churches would have, out of just about 3% of their total income, plenty to take care of all the disabled people in America. We wouldn't need the federal government for any of it.
Stunning statistic. Very, very, yeah, that's amazing.
It is.
All right,
and
Cal,
then we wouldn't be going to the state and treating it as if it were God.
Right.
I mean, what are we supposed to pray? Our Father in heaven, give, hallowed be thy name, et cetera. Give us this day our daily bread. Or our Father in Washington, give us this day our daily bread.
Right, right.
So we make an idol of the state.
Yeah, I have to take a break, Cal. I just have one quick question. Does Inky get wet food or only dry food?
Well, Inky got both. Inky was actually my cat in my childhood.
Oh, okay, okay. All right. If you have a question for Dr. Cal Beisner, you can certainly ask. We've got time for 1-877-933-2484, 877-933-2484. After a very short break, we'll be right back. Welcome back to the show. The Big Hands on the 49, so 11 minutes until the top of the hour. Dr. Cal Beisner is my guest. You can go to thecornwallalliance.org to check him out. We're talking about his pamphlet or booklet, Social Justice versus Biblical Justice. Cal, I would love for you to weigh in on really the social justice, the movement that's going on today, and how biblical is it, and have we strayed away from the biblical mandate?
Yeah. Yes, in fact, I'm very, very concerned about this. And actually, Bill, it's a revival of what has kind of popped its head up every once in a while through the last 150 years or so of American church history and church history around other parts of the world as well. Social justice doesn't typically get defined very clearly, but when you look carefully at how it's being used and what the people who promote it are asking for, it tends to end up looking something like government adopting policies that ensure that there is either equality of income, equality of wealth, or at least some closer approximation to it than whatever we happen to have at any given point. And, of course, the only way that government can do that is by forcibly taking from some people what belongs to them and giving to others what doesn't belong to them. We call that theft. The Eighth Commandment does not say, you shall not steal unless you are the government. It just says, you shall not steal. So that's the basic case. And basically, it tends to be socialistic in outcome or in outlook. Back in the 1980s, a number of different writers, including myself, wrote books that I think very convincingly refuted all of the different arguments from professedly Christian writers in favor of social justice or socialism. And, frankly, I was naive enough back then, 35 years ago, I was naive enough back then to think, aha, we've won the battle intellectually. This one's down. We don't have to go back to this. And as a matter of fact, the main proponents of those ideas basically went kind of silent for about two decades. But in the early 2000s, we saw them, such as Jim Wallis of Sojourners and Tony Campolo and Ron Sider of Evangelicals for Social Action, we saw them coming out again with the same old arguments, same old case for wealth redistribution out of the Bible, not dealing at all with the biblical critiques that had been voiced in the 1980s, which I think is rather sad.
Yeah. Why does the Bible speak so much about doing justice for the poor?
Oh, because the poor are so often the targets of injustice, precisely because they're poor. Mm-hmm. They're more vulnerable than other people. I mean, they can't afford, burglar alarms on their homes. They can't afford, strong defenses. And if they are harmed, they can't afford a good attorney and things of that sort, right? And so that means the poor are far more frequently the objects of crime, of injustice, than are the rich. So that's why the Bible so often tells us that we are supposed to do justice to the poor. But what it means by doing justice to the poor is making sure that all the same laws that protect other people from harm protect them from harm, and that the laws that protect other people from unjust accusations, false charges, protect them from false charges as well. All the laws are supposed to treat everybody the same. Leviticus tells us explicitly, you should not favor the poor or the rich in any dispute. We're supposed to be impartial and proportional in our application of justice to everybody.
Cal, how much in denial are we about the idea that the country is roughly $20+ trillion in debt? Whoever thinks about
oh my.
That? I mean, it's such a staggering
denial
number.
Denial is in flood.
Yeah. I mean, because if we try to,
We're stealing from future generations to squander this stuff on ourselves. And that's, I mean, talk about injustice. What we're doing is we're stealing from people who not only are vulnerable now, they're not even around now to try to protect themselves, to make their own case against our stealing. This is, Bill, this is just gross injustice, and what we need to do is to get government on a very, very short leash and just simply say, look, the state cannot spend more than it takes in every year, and as a matter of fact, it needs to pay back all the debts that it has. That would put a bit of a crimp in the federal budget for a while, I think.
Well, but price of gas goes up 5 cents and people throw a fit. And then you read in the news that they've added another trillion to the debt. And that doesn't seem to affect us.
Short-sighted. And besides that, when you go and you buy your gas at the pump, you're spending your own money directly and you see the price. But when the federal debt goes up by $1 trillion, you just think, well, the federal government owns it or owes that debt. I don't owe it. But the fact is, it's every one of us who pay the taxes that help to pay the debt. So we should be taking that into consideration.
Mm-hmm.
We should not, fall for it.
Yeah. Cal, in one of my earlier discussions I had with my previous guest, was talking a little bit about the homeless situation in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a little homeless encampment that's gone up in my hometown of Minneapolis. Now there's close to 300 residents living in tents. And at a press conference, one of the representatives from this little tent community was saying, what is the city going to do about getting us housing and getting us out of the winter environment? And my heart broke because I'm thinking, well, the problems are so complex, the drug addiction, and what are you going to do to start taking responsibility for that? And how are you going to let us help you with that? And do you want to stop?
Yeah, what's really interesting, Bill, and studies have shown this over and over again for more than 30 years, the homeless population tends to be primarily people who really want to be homeless.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to have a long-term, steady residence. And yet, people will look at them and advocates will say, see, these people desperately need housing. Well, yeah, I don't disagree with that. But the first thing you have to do is to convince them that they need housing. And then you need to convince them to do the kinds of things that lead to their having housing. But there, as you said, there are major drug problems. Mental illness is very, very common among the homeless in this country. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't be compassionate.
Mm-hmm.
But we do need to make sure, as the great economist Walter Williams put it, that truly compassionate policy requires dispassionate analysis. And so I think that the first thing for us to do is to recognize that what is probably more needed in these people's lives than anything else is the transformation that happens when they are when they meet Jesus Christ and place their faith in him, and the Holy Spirit comes to live in them, and he begins to transform their lives, shaping them after the image of Christ. That's the number one need. And then after that, our churches should be working with them, discipling them, training them on such basic things as getting up on time in the morning, getting to work on time, dressing decently, keeping clean, basic things like that that make them employable.
Yeah. I just went 0-for-4 with your list, Cal. That's kind of a bummer. So let me direct my listeners once again to cornwallalliance.org, and you can download get the gift of social justice and biblical justice with a gift donation of any size. But please go to that website and look it over, because it's a fantastic website. Cal, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Well, thank you very much, Bill. I always enjoy being
on the show with you. Oh, I do too. I learned so much. Dr. Cal Beisner has been my guest, and the cornwallalliance.org is the website. After a short break, we'll be back with Hour 2. Susie Larson will be with us for the whole hour. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.